Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
And welcome back to Masters of Modern. I'm your host, Alex Kessler, with my co-host, Ben Bateman.
What's going on, everybody?
Today, we are talking about a specific card. It's our first time just looking at a card and talking about all the things that card can accomplish. We're cheating for our first time doing this. We're picking a card that's relatively complicated. We're doing Liliana the Veil.
Awesome card.
This is the regional PTQ promo. Definitely one of the most powerful cards of all time. It sees play in every format, period, other than maybe Vintage. Maybe the grindy lack of card advantage doesn't really work there, but definitely, you know, a format warping all-star.
Yeah, you guys may be asking yourselves, why are you guys focusing on one card? And if you are, why is it not a card that is more commonly played in all colors, like Lightning Bolt or something like that? And the reason is because we feel there's more play to this card. It's more interesting to look at the various decks that it fits into, as well as different ways to play the card. Also,
we've talked about Lightning Bolt. We did a whole removal episode of different answers in the format. So this is our first time going kind of into Liliana, and we might do Lightning Bolt in the future.
And I think the last reason for me is because if you look back to 2007 and before, there were no Planeswalkers. Now when they print a powerful Planeswalker, it's almost just assumed that it's going to fit into powerful decks in a format like Modern, whereas the kind of versatility and the sort of impossibly hard to get rid of nature of Planeswalkers, they didn't exist back then. They exist now. They're all over Modern, and we just sort of want to look at this card and what makes it so good.
So before we get into that, I want to mention, follow us on Twitter and iTunes. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes, and make sure to follow us on Twitter and tweet at us while we're talking. If you want to say something mean or nice, hopefully, we will respond. If it's mean, we'll respond kindly. We'll kill you with kindness. That's our motto.
We have thick skin. We have hardened
so
scales.
Thick. I mean, I'm going to cry a little bit every time you say something mean, but it's okay. My tears are good for the world. There's a drought in California. on iTunes, rate us, subscribe, like us there. Also, we have a YouTube channel. If you go to YouTube and search for Top Decking TV, you'll find us there. Cool. Moving on to Liliana the Veil. She's a Planeswalker. She was part of the... Liliana herself was part of the first original five Planeswalkers.
The initial five were a really elegant design back in 2007. They designed them before them. They came out in Lorwyn Block before there was Mythic Rarity. It didn't exist yet. It was about 2 years before that. And they did one for each color. And I remember... So they referenced Planeswalkers originally on the card Tarmogoyf. It was the first time on a card they had told us they were coming.
Right, and that was the set. That came out the block before Planeswalkers even showed up.
Because they referenced it as a creature type that you have to be aware of.
But this was a set with, like, Steamflogger boss, so a lot of people were like, oh, that's probably just, like, a weird, like, jokey. They're never going to come out with this card.
They also referenced Tribal, which is the other thing that came out of Lorwyn. So,
right.
Which didn't stick, apparently, because we haven't seen anything.
They're done. They refuse to make Tribal anymore.
Okay.
It's actually, like, a debunked. I mean, it still exists because cards exist with Tribal.
Right.
And it's still, like, a permanent type, but they will never print another tribal card.
So the initial five Planeswalkers were Liliana Vess, which is the 5-mana original version of the card we're going to talk about. I mean, version in the sense of the character. There's Jace Beleren, which is 3-mana Jace, often referred to as Baby Jace. There's Garrick Wildspeaker, which is 4-mana Garrick. He's probably the most underplayed in the modern format now relative to his power level.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue he's top 10, if not closer to 5.
It's a good card.
Yeah.
Ajani Goldmane, which is original Ajani, 4-mana Ajani. And the last one is Chandra Nalar, which is probably of the five, the one that maybe didn't understand its place in the color wheel for its color as much at the time.
Well, so what Wizards was trying to do when they released these five Planeswalkers was kind of, here is our Justice League. It's literally what they were doing. I mean, like, Mark Rosewar has come out and said, like, we made these characters because before Planeswalkers were kind of this ubiquitous, ethereal, godlike beings.
Are you guys Planeswalkers? Are the characters Planeswalkers?
And how do you tell stories about these characters?
Yeah, right.
So, like, they've created these. I mean, part of it, and I think one of the reasons Wizards finally made a deal with Fox to do movies is because we have characters now. We have characters that are recognizable, and there's IP behind them, and there's people care about it. So,
and they really, I mean, when you look at, like, what happened with, we talked about this with Tom Lapilli last week, but if you look at what happened around that time when they rebranded with New World Order, which we won't go into, but that was a whole sort of rebranding of the game at a simpler level to make it more accessible to newer players. When they did that, they introduced these around the same time, within a couple years of it. These were beforehand.
This is kind of... So there was a big switch, and everyone... I mean, most people listening are probably somehow affected by this because, you know, Magic went from like just kind of a level growth, not too much growth, not too much decline for years.
Yeah.
Like after Mirrodin, basically. And then it skyrocketed. Since M10, there's been 20% growth every year consistently.
Yeah. We were like somewhere between like 12 and 15 million worldwide players, I think, for quite a while.
And now we're like closer to the 20s plus.
High 20s, yeah.
And I think a couple things had to do with this, and this is a little bit off subject, but I think part of it was Planeswalker showing up, which is why it's on subject. I think New World Order had something to do with it to make it easier for new players to kind of learn. I think Duels of the Planeswalkers, the set, yeah, existing, the game
big
just
time,
being a thing that, you know, people on iPad liking it. And I think nerd culture in general has become a much more popular and it's cool. It's not cool, but at least it's more socially acceptable to be into really nerdy things.
Well, and social media creates that reality for everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody's so connected now. But the thing I was going to say is that if you look at what's happened since the Planeswalkers and New World Order, the growth of the game has been so parallel to the printing of these Planeswalkers and these characters. So you talk about they're going to make movies now, and these are the characters in the movies. Well, not only that, all those players that came in the huge influx over the last 8 years, every single one of them knows about Planeswalkers.
Yeah.
They all are fully aware and familiar. So so that's the initial five, and that was the explosion, and I think they were pretty well received. I really like this initial five, the Justice League, you call it.
Yeah.
I think it's very well done.
Well, and they've kind of all fallen into being the main characters of the story since then, and we're about to, you know, see some of their origins in, yeah, Magic Origins. I mean, Jace has been, to some people's chagrin, the main character of Magic to, yeah, a certain extent. Liliana has been kind of in and out of the major storyline and one of the most played tournament cards of all time. Same as Jace, theoretically. Johnny has become kind of the Obi-Wan Kenobi of the five of them in the group. Sure. And Chandra is just doing her thing.
Right, stepchild.
Garrick's now a bad guy.
So you go from the initial five. Then the next block was a fully multicolored block. It was Shards of Alara, which is kind of when you came into tournament Magic, right? Shards block?
M10. I literally showed up, bought a third of a box of all of Shards block because they were out of M10 and I just wanted to buy a box. And that was my like introduction to Magic.
So you opened at least one Planeswalker?
Yeah. So I opened none of the Shards. I started and I bought a pack of M10.
Yeah.
And foiled Jace Bellerin.
Oh, nice.
Like the first card. I actually have
a sweet looking foil too.
I still have it. I think Mark Rosewater signed it at Comic-Con.
Oh, cool.
Like at one point. All right, still signed. I don't think you can unsign a card very easily. It definitely hooked me on the game. I would argue it's one of the reasons I got into it.
Well, the full-on gambling element.
I just opened $30.
So the run of Planeswalkers that showed up in Shards block.
What's interesting here is there's an argument to be made that of the top 10 Planeswalkers, if not earlier, three of these are in the top five, like six.
Well, yeah, because they had the initial five, and I think they were really focused on power balance, and they were all monocolored, so they're like, okay, this makes sense, they fits the color, and then they're like, well, we're going to make multicolored Planeswalkers now, but they hadn't released the initial five
right
when they were designing the second run, so they were just going completely on theory, how powerful these things were going to be, were they going to be accepted, can we push the boundaries?
Well, so like, okay, so a Johnny Vengeant, tournament staple, one of the best Planeswalkers ever printed.
Really, really strong. Yeah.
Elsbeth, third best Planeswalker, second best. Let me rephrase that. First best Planeswalker until Jace, and probably third best at this point. Tezzeret sees vintage play consistently, sees legacy play occasionally, saw standard play relatively.
Yeah, what a strange class. And you have Sarkhan Vol, and you have Nicol Bolas Planeswalker.
Sarkhan Vol, like the first bust Planeswalker that saw no play, and the Nicol Bolas, major villain. Casual favorite, control.
So four of these were from Shards, and then Nicol Bolas was from Conflux?
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. They changed the model already. In the second set, they were just like, we're not going to put them all in one set.
Well, I think they were originally probably going to, and they realized, oh, it'd be way cooler if Nicol Bolas came out in the second one, and we just kind of hint that he's coming.
So I would argue that these are very powerful, but they definitely like went way all over the place with like thematically and color wise. Like,
well, part of that had to do with the shards they were from. I mean, like, Tezzeret was artifact themed because Esper was a thing. You know, Elsbeth was like, I'm gonna pump my one dude into the sky because Bant was like all about that.
No. I just mean like you make a mono blue, a mono white, a Boros, a Gruul, and then just like a Grixis.
Yep.
Just rando. Like, there's no cycle here.
You're in shards block. It's weird.
There's no balance. So it's a well-designed block. It's
I mean, if you look at this, like, most sets are kind of weird like that, where they have, like, Theros had, three gold Planeswalkers?
No, agreed. I mean, now it's, like, sort of standard that they're random, but just compared to the initial five as a player.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you get this set of Planeswalkers, and now you're starting to think, okay, I can see where they're going. This is going to be a thing we get every set. This is really interesting. The gameplay here, it feels very different. It fits in really well. They did a really great job of integrating the mechanics and something as simple as, like, loyalty counters, which at the time when they introduced it was really weird. This idea that your card would almost have, like, a life total.
Well, if you look at the Lorwyn promotional materials, like, almost 50% of it was designated towards explaining what Planeswalkers do and how they work. Like, right. All the little insert things that you get in decks and all that stuff is all just, like, Lorwyn's about fantasy. Okay, Planeswalkers work this way. Let me sit you down and explain it to you, young child.
So now you finish up with the shards. You get into Zendikar Block. Now here's where you really, like, this is I think where the initial run, because I think they were designing.
What's interesting about Zendikar Block to me is, until Rise of the Eldrazi at least, the power level differentiation between Jace the Mind Sculptor and every other Planeswalker is so large.
Yeah.
Like, you have Nissa, who saw play, but is arguably, like, not that good of a Planeswalker.
No.
You have Big Chandra, who, like, the second red Planeswalker that did nothing in the format.
And
you have
mana, yeah.
Big Sorin, who also, like, EDH favorite because he drains you for 10, puts you at 10. That's 30 life swing, but, like, in regular Magic didn't see a ton of play. And then you have Jace. And then, you know, this card is of a power level comparatively to Memory Jar and Skull Clamp of, like, one of the three eras that standard cards were banned.
Like, so preposterously good.
Right.
So, now,
Gideon came out eventually, and arguably he's up there with top 10 Planeswalkers of all time, and he's very strong.
And the reason that we are talking so much about Planeswalker history is because we're really trying to make it clear that Jace came out, and Jace was kind of almost immediately, within probably on the same level of Tarmogoyf, within 3 weeks of release. I mean,
he spoiled out a $30 card. By the time Rise of Eldrazi came out, he was a $70 card.
Yeah, so in the same way that Goyf was a little more under the radar. Goyf took about 3 to 4 weeks before it was like...
Well, Goyf was a rare
that
did things weird. Jace was a Planeswalker mythic rare, and this was like... Elsbeth at this time was $45.
Yeah.
So there was already the, like, cap of the most expensive Planeswalker of Elsbeth.
I'm not
and,
talking
like,
price.
At this point, mythics also were, like... Well, ubiquitous at power level, but, like, the other mythic, like, two big mythics at this time were Elsbeth and the Angel.
Elsbeth and Baneslayer Angel.
Yeah. And both of them had, like, a $40 to $65 price point at that point. So Jace comes out at $30, which is a steal, as we all know at this point. But, like, the world was very quick to realize, oh, this card's probably the best Planeswalker ever printed.
It is, and it was. So we all deal with Jace, and it gets banned out of Standard, which, along with Stoneforge Mystic, because Cobblade was the stupidest deck ever. And I remember playing it, I remember playing against it, and... So at this point, I think as a player base, we're all looking and we're saying, okay, they're never going to print a Planeswalker this good again. But here's the problem. The problem is you design Magic 2 years ahead of time. So the whole thing with Jace the Mind Sculptor coming out and being completely breaking the format, that card was being designed around the time that Lorwyn came out. So, like, they had just released the first Planeswalkers.
Right.
And this card was already in the tank.
And he's Jace, and they like, definitely ahead of time realize, okay, blue is the best color. Blue is 90% of Magic's favorite
they
color.
They wanted to push it. They really wanted to push it.
Jace is probably the most similar to our player base as, like, a semi-introverted, you know, smart dude.
Right.
And so let's push his second appearance. And so they did, and he got 4 abilities and was just bonkers.
So now here's what I think is really interesting. Jace comes out. We all go crazy. It gets banned. Liliana's already on the printing press. Like, she's already ready to roll. Like, that card...
Oh, yeah, she's coming... Like, when Jace was banned, she was probably already printed.
Yeah.
Like, Innistrad was already at printing.
Yeah. So then Liliana comes out. And this is where our history is going to stop. We're going to... And I believe this was...
Small history. I mean, Liliana Veil came out. So to explain what Liliana the Veil is, for people that don't know, it's the second three-color Planeswalker after Jace.
Three-mana Planeswalker.
She has 3 abilities. The first one is everyone discards a card.
For plus one.
The second one is a -2. Target player sacks a creature. And the last one is -6. And target player divides all permanents they control into 2 piles. And you destroy one of them.
And that's, like, not... As with most Planeswalkers, the Ultimate is kind of icing on the cake. Most of the time, Planeswalker's ultimate abilities only get used if you're in some sort of silly, grindy, long control game or EDH. Well, generally,
the cheaper the Planeswalker, the easier it is to come back from their ultimate, because they realize that the earlier it comes in, the quicker it'll ultimate. So they want to make it a little bit... Like, you can survive a Liliana ultimate. You can, like, Jace Bellerin's ultimate does nothing.
Right. But that's... But, I mean, the cheap Planeswalkers, the point of them is that is usually ability 1 and 2.
Right.
So, I think it's pretty clear that this Liliana... It took a second. It definitely took a second when this card was printed. Just like all the good ones, it took at least a few weeks before people really.
No. You don't remember, apparently, but like out of the gate, everyone.
It was 60. I remember.
It was 90 at one point. Within the first 3 weeks, it was $90 because of Solar Flare. It like did well at like a Star City game IQ standard, and like. Everyone thought it was just going to be the best. I mean, it went down after that. It went
maybe
back
that's
to like
what
50,
I'm remembering.
But it was like at $90 within 2 weeks.
Maybe
of it,
I'm remembering
the
price depression. Like, right, it came out and people went nuts. And then I think I remember noticing the price depression and thinking, oh, okay, this card's not that good.
Well, so the thing you have to remember is this is the first super powerful Planeswalker that was printed since Jace.
Right.
And so, Jace was $150 standard card.
So ridiculous.
So, like, people reacted to this. And for a while, people reacted to every Planeswalker in such a volatile manner. Now people have kind of calmed down and realized, you know, if it's good, it's probably a $30 card. If it's bad, it's a $10 card. And most of the time, it's somewhere in between those two price points. And so the card definitely showed up to the scene and was guns blazing.
Okay.
The interesting – I mean, like, I would argue, and I've argued with many times, the top three Planeswalkers are probably Jace, Liliana, Elsbeth.
That's pretty fair. I mean, you could make an argument for –
a Johnny over Elsbeth or
a Johnny Vengeant or one of the Tezzerets based on like context ability.
Yeah.
You know, Vintage.
Like in Vintage, Tezzeret sees way more play than any other Planeswalker than maybe Jace.
Take a quick look at the 58 Planeswalkers that have ever been printed. There's any other. Karn is very powerful.
Karn is powerful. I'd put Karn up there. But before we get into a top 10 Planeswalkers list, which
like
we will eventually
do.
Important thing with Planeswalkers to keep in mind is, do they protect themselves? That's kind of the main barrier, the barrier that they have to pass to be able to be playable. And Liliana does that. Liliana comes into play, kills a creature, and then just sits there and wrecks your opponent's day if they let her stick around.
Yeah, she's a particularly infuriating card to play against. So I guess this is where we get into the actual play breakdown of the card.
Right.
So let's go ability by ability really quickly and just sort of think about what each one of these means in a game state. The first one being +1. So a turn 3, or if you're accelerating, a turn 2, which is like back in the day with Deathrite Shaman.
Right, and that's one of the reasons Deathrite Shaman was so good, because Deathrite Shaman into Liliana the Veil is nuts. Turn 2, Liliana the Veil is... I mean, like, my best Star City Games open finish was, I think, 10th at SCGLA like 3 years ago at the Legacy. And I was playing Pox. And the only reason that deck is good is because you can Dark Ritual into Liliana Veil on turn 1. You wreck every opponent that you're playing.
So one of the first things I noticed about this is that effects that allow you to discard cards for advantage are very rare. Sometimes they come on the back of a spell. Like, you can additionally discard cards to the spell, but then you're putting yourself down the card that you had to play to do that. Sometimes they're on the back of a creature ability.
I mean, Mind Rot is the classic one, and that... is a 3-mana ability.
I'm saying making yourself discard cards.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes, like, Una's Prowler or a card like that has a repeatable discard. But again, they can discard cards to make the creature bad, so it just turns that card into a bad card.
Right.
With this card, you're playing it for 3, you're plussing it, and if you have some ability that wants to put your own cards from your hand into your graveyard for any kind of, like, a resurrection ability or just cards that have flashbacks.
I mean, Solar Flare, the point of Solar Flare was that she was printed at the same time that Unburial Rites was printed. So you discard Sun Titan with Liliana the Veil, and then you use Unburial Rites to bring her back.
It's really, really powerful. It's a rare ability, and that's the first thing you notice about this card is that it's... An actively repeatable effect that allows you to discard your own cards and get cards out of their hand at the same time.
But yeah, so I guess my point, even beyond that, so the way Liliana's play pattern generally plays out, because the biggest deck that plays it are the Jund and Junk decks in Modern. And the way generally they use it is use her to put us both in top decking mode, but I control what's going to happen, and you no longer have instant spells. You no longer can save a spell for some reason. You no longer have answers to my threats because we both have to play them immediately or I'm going to make you discard your card, and I get to play mine before I use her ability, so I'm locking you out of the game, which is super powerful. Anytime you have repeatable discard, it's powerful. And in this situation, you – like, it's similar to how Stax plays in Legacy, where you – even though it's a both-sided effect, you can take advantage of it because you have control of when it's going to happen.
So that's the first ability. The second ability is -2, target player sacrifices a creature. Now, this is insane. It's insane that they decided to do this as opposed to destroy target creature, because they really could have just done destroy target creature.
Destroy target creature would be at both. Yes, it would be less powerful in the sense that it doesn't kill Geist of St. Traft, but in reality, I think, A, this is when Hexproof was coming out. This is when they, this era is the first expert expansion with
heavily pushed. Hexproof. They printed Invisible Sucker in the same set.
And Geist, both were in the same set. So, having that sac ability was probably important for balance reasons, but also, it does lower the power level generally, and we're going to get to how to kind of fight Liliana, and the reason you, sac ability, because I get to choose. But the important thing is that because she comes down so early, most often your opponent's not going to have 7 creatures in play. They're going to have the one they played that is the only way they can attack Liliana, and she's going to be able to get that out of the way, and then from that point on take over the game by discarding.
I would argue that the -1 sac ability is infinitely more powerful than destroy target creature would have been, and that's because competitive level Magic often has evasive and difficult to get rid of creatures that are sometimes untargetable. Making somebody sacrifice a creature in more skilled formats, I think, is much more valuable. It seems to me.
But it definitely offers her weakness along with her strength. If you could just destroy any creature, then I could just shoot their Rhino, and then Lingering Soul tokens are fine.
Agreed. I mean, we can argue semantics on this, but the point is, so...
Right. The way the playstyle works is you play her. If they have a threat out, you sack it. You make them sacrifice it. And then once you get her past 3 loyalty again, you pretty much run away with the game. It's unbeatable because if they're not able to attack her and you're able to get her the 3 loyalty, then from that point on, they can't play a creature unless they play 2.
And they have to draw those cards without you making them discard.
Right. Yeah. So it kind of is a weird way of locking you out of the game, because you can only play a threat at a time. And if you're not drawing threats, then she pluses and gains more ability to get rid of your threats.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that you can gauge a Planeswalker on is if you look at the minus ability, whatever their premier minus ability is, you say to yourself, okay, for the mana that I'm paying, this is a sorcery speed spell that's going to get me this one ability guaranteed. And if that's the ability I'm going to get, is this worth the base level of that plus whatever else I can get out of it if they can't get rid of it right away? And generally speaking, if that's what you're going to gauge, 3 mana, sorcery speed, target player sacrifices a creature, and then I have a live Planeswalker if you don't get rid of me, is insane.
Right.
That's insane. That's it's one mana higher than the rate you would probably play a normal standard spell. 2 mana, target player sacrifices a creature at sorcery speed. That's like a played control kind of spell. And then the fact that for 1 more mana now I get a Planeswalker, it's the same thing with most of the really, really good ones, you know. As you said, can it protect itself? Absolutely, it can protect itself.
Yeah. And it does it in 2 ways. Both of its abilities really protect itself, because one makes it so they can't play multiple cards a turn, and the best way to fight a Planeswalker is because they go wide, and the other one prevents them from keeping things in play.
Yeah.
So how do you beat that? Now, there's some cool other abilities that she kind of, the interesting thing with her in Modern is she pairs so well with cards like Lingering Souls.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
And that's kind of what you were saying before, where it's now, instead of we both lose cards, it's you lose a card and I draw a card. My card is now cheaper. I gain a mana. And so, it definitely makes her so much more powerful. And it is kind of the way, you know, and we mentioned Lingering Souls and Liliana are kind of doing a little dance of how they function with each other in the format. Because Lingering Souls is also the best answer to her.
Right.
Because it completely nullifies her minus ability and plus ability. If you have Lingering Souls against Liliana, it's great.
And if she makes you discard it, then you just play it and you get creatures. Now you can just kill Liliana.
So I guess what we're saying is play Lingering Souls.
That card's just good. I frequently find myself getting to a third and fourth color in my brews because I'm just I should just be able to play Lingering Souls. It'll just make this deck better.
So I guess next I want to talk about how does this card play
actually,
against...
On that note, little Easter egg, guys. Try playing Goblin Electromancer into Lingering Souls. It's so sweet. Electromancer turn 2, Souls, Flashback, Souls on turn 3. I tried to douse a 4-color deck I tried making.
And then your life total is at, 13 out of the bat? Because you need 4 colors at that point.
And then you play, Rally the Peasants. You play, Rally the Peasants with your Electromancer because you can play it twice. It's so sweet. I actually built this deck at one point. I actually sleeved it up, and I took it to, Heidi Ho and just was laughed out of the room. It didn't work at all.
That doesn't surprise me.
Tribal Flames. He played Tribal Flames as well. One mana Tribal Flames.
Yeah.
Five color.
Yeah.
It's just worse than Zoo.
Right. Okay, moving on. How does Liliana, how do you beat a Liliana? And there's kind of two ways to do it in the format. One is aggro creature strategies that go wide. So Zoo is like, speaking of Zoo, a great card against Liliana.
Tokens
is great against Liliana. As we mentioned, really, Lingering Souls is really
good. Burn's really good against it.
Burn is really good. Because the two ways to really fight it are things that kill it individually. So Lightning Bolt, Abrupt Decay, you know, Answers. Or going wide and just attacking into her. Because she doesn't protect herself that well against multiple creatures. The point is, though, on turn three, and arguably your opponent's turn two if you're going first, they don't have that many creatures in play. But if they're able to go Goblin Guide into Tarmogoyf,
yeah,
then she's pretty much done for.
It's so frustrating, though, because no matter what, they're getting a 2-for-1 out of you. They're going to get a 2-for-1. Like, they're going to get rid of your creature, and then you're going to have to burn something to get rid of her.
Right.
Or they're going to make you discard a card, and then your other burn spells can take care of her.
Right.
But, like, in either case, it's just... It's ridiculous.
I mean, she mind rots a person, I guess.
Yeah.
But
worst case.
So, and then... that's kind of how to beat her. The decks that do the worst, I would argue, are control decks.
Yeah.
Because you can't just wait with her.
You can counter her, I guess.
Kind of. Yes, you can. That's definitely a possibility.
Thoughts your counter out,
yeah,
first, though.
Like, and that comes to the other side of Liliana, is she's in black, which means you get Thoughtseize. And I would argue, and I've argued this before, that Liliana is the only 3-drop in sorcery speed 3-drop playable in Modern.
Yeah, we could get into a whole argument about this, but Etch Champion has an argument. It's a sorcery speed 3-drop that's really good.
Fair. Okay, only maybe is strong, but I would argue that Affinity also plays Thoughtseize, so...
Yeah. I mean, yeah, agreed. They're very rare.
Right.
You can't play Geist, which is your favorite card, which is why you always make this point, because
so
you want to be able to play Geist
it.
In Modern.
I just
want to
play Geist and stay trapped. It's so good. All right. The answer might be playing Geist and the Liliana. Moving on. The last kind of thing is mid-range, and mid-range is right now just Lingering Souls, and we kind of talked about how that affects Liliana, and she either loves it or hates it, depending on who has the Lingering Souls on the table. Abrupt Decay is probably her biggest weakness in the format.
Yeah.
But Abrupt Decay is also one answer in many, and normally you start with a Tarmogoyf into Liliana, so...
Again, like... my 3-drop that I would play, like my really powerful 3-drop that's like a creature, we'll say.
Yeah.
I'd play it, and then you'd decay it. It's a 1-for-1.
Right.
I play Liliana, and I make you discard a card, and I probably get advantage out of discarding a card, and then you decay it.
Right.
It's still a 2-for-1.
Right.
And that's your best removal spell.
Right.
So, absurd. It's just such a... Is it too powerful? That's the first question.
Is Liliana too powerful? I don't think so. It's possible. I mean... this sees tons of play in Legacy, which is the first sign of something maybe being too powerful. But I don't think this is the reason that these green-black decks are so powerful. I think it definitely offers play for them, but I think that the cards like Abrupt Decay and Thoughtseize are more of the danger from them.
I think that this card, it's not too powerful. This card to me represents exactly the kind of Planeswalker I want in Modern. It represents exactly the kind of power level that I think the Modern format wants to have. And that's because it's a competitively powerful 3-drop, as you said, which is it's a rare effect in Modern. And on top of that, I think that the play that it offers, the modes that it has, are so relevant to the gameplay against all the other powerful decks. But as you said, there are enough strategies in Modern, enough aggressive strategies and interesting combo strategies that don't care about Liliana that they can go around her.
Right.
But she fights fair decks so well.
Right.
I don't think she oppresses. I don't feel like if you banned Liliana or something, there would be like this whole wealth of other decks that would pop up.
Agreed.
Yeah.
She sees enough play in multiple different strategies. She also encourages some of the more tier 3 decks like... 8-rack or, you know, 8-post and, like, all these decks that are trying to, like, discard themed. And there's,
right.
like, I know I've played against discard infect decks that are kind of interesting before. And, you know, she probably would side into, like, a mono-black devotion shell. She was actually originally supposed to be in standard right now, but they realized that her in devotion is just the most nuts thing
just
they could have ever done.
Yeah.
Imagine last year's standard of playing, like...
Pack rat
into Liliana of the Veil, into, Grey Merchant sounds just like unbeatable. I don't know how anyone could beat that
sounds
tech.
Sounds really unfair. Yeah, yeah.
Now, before we get into the deck tech for the day, I do kind of want to talk about some of the tips and tricks with Liliana. I think there's a few things. And one of them we mentioned is just play Lingering Souls with her.
Yeah.
It's obviously very powerful. But things that, you know, kind of people don't realize you can do. I forget who said it, but the most underused ability of Liliana is not using it. So often people feel like they have to make you discard or they have to do something with it. But you can remember that if you have cards you want to hold on to, don't use her plus ability. Just let her sit there. She's still a threat people have to worry about, but you don't have to kind of wreck yourself and your playstyle by plussing when you have cards you need. The second kind of thing is, you know, when you're playing her, you're best playing in tap out control decks. A lot of times people are like, oh, I'm playing a control deck that wants to hold up Mana Leak. She doesn't play well with counter spells because you have to discard your own spells.
Right.
Your hand needs to be something to tap out. The reason she's so good at mid-range is because you just want to play your spells when you get them. You want to play Tarmogoyf as soon as it's in your hand and you can cast it. You want to play Rhino immediately afterwards.
Right.
So, like, a lot of times people are like, oh, I can play her in a control shell because she, like, locks out other control players. But in the reality, she's also hurting your game plan.
Yeah.
And so if they're able to get threats on the board, control's bad at getting threats on the board, and you want to be able to hold up removal spells.
One card that, and this is, I think we talked about this on the 8th edition podcast, but a card I discovered recently that I haven't actually tried against Liliana, but I like the sound of, is this card called Guerrilla Tactics. I think that's what it's called. It's a red burn spell, one red, one colorless for two damage at instant speed, but if an opponent's ability makes you discard it, it does 4 damage, which means if it's in your hand and a Liliana plus against you, it just goes out of your hand and kills Liliana. Which seems really good to me.
Well, I guess on that note, there's a ton of cards that see a lot of play because Liliana exists.
Yeah, locks it on Whitley Smiter.
Whitley Fleece, Whitley plays, Lee, yep. Locks it on Smiter, Obstinate Baloth. Like, these are cards that literally they see play because Liliana's in the format.
Yeah.
Like, you're not thought-seizing those cards out of people's hands because you can thought-seize and be like, eh, no, I don't want to take that. But Liliana the Veil is, like, it's huge game when she pluses and you're like, well, I have a Locks it on Smiter to play now.
Right.
Good luck.
Probably better than Guerrilla Tactics.
Probably better.
Yeah.
Because you can also cast it for 3, and then you have a 4/4.
And generally speaking, 2 mana shock is bad.
Yeah. Beyond that, you know, the reason she's so strong right now is because her plus Thoughtseize plus Abrupt Decay.
Plus Lingering Souls.
Plus... Well, but even plus, like, plus like she saw a ton of play. Yeah, plus Tarmogoyf. I mean, like, even before Lingering Souls, the choice was Lingering Souls or Jund. But I guess Jund was splashing for Lingering Souls into Johnny. So, like,
yeah,
she's so strong. She's definitely the reason mid-range is a deck.
Yeah, yeah. And I think they're smart. And I think that they know that they don't want to ban Liliana. I don't think it's too powerful either. I think they'll continue to design cards that will encourage the play of this card. And I also think, see, I always love seeing cards like this because it's got a unique set of abilities, and like I said, it's difficult to find advantageous cards to make yourself discard.
Right.
You know, there's enough cards.
There's
in
a
Magic.
Lot of play with her.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. There's definitely a lot of, like, the interaction levels are huge. The amount of choices that are interesting that she makes players make is very good for the game. So it's definitely a playstyle that isn't negative.
Agreed.
And a lot of people hate on mid-range in the format, but in reality, people would be hating on any format that's dominant, and at least mid-range offers, you know, some ability to have stuff on board and interaction and play.
It's
versus...
just, it's fair Magic. It's a bunch of mid-range costed and fairly curved out good cards.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't have some overwhelmingly powerful, like, unbeatable.
Right. And I do think if Liliana Veil was in the format, there are decks that become too strong even. She's really the only good sac effect in the format.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you could, if Liliana Veil.
Like,
well, now I'm just brewing in my head.
Stop.
Geist Brews.
All right, now.
Geist Brews?
Okay, that's all we're talking about for the rest of the day is Geist Ascent Draft and how great he is. Okay, moving on. So that's kind of it for Liliana the Veil. I mean, not it. Like, there's more we could probably say. We actually recorded, like, 15 minutes of just talking about the history of Planeswalkers, but we deleted that, and you don't have to listen to it.
And then we did it again, and you had to listen.
But today we're actually... To kind of give a history of what the deck's trying to do, it's trying to kill your opponent. It's trying to kill your opponent's spells.
As fast as possible.
This kind of deck has also been called Red Deck Wins in the past, and in Standard it's generally called that because...
Or Sly.
I think arguably Sly and Burn are two ends of the Red Deck Wins strategy graph. they're different parts of the axis.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Like, in standard, it kind of goes between how much burn it is, which I think, like, during, like, last year, there was more of a burn strategy where you're literally just pointing spells at their face.
Right.
Versus now, where red deck wins is much more about, like, creature on the board attacking. And
Island of the Great Realms.
Yes. Well, so, and that's kind of the card that was printed that kind of threw burn into the stratosphere. Before Eidolon, burn was a tier 2 deck. And people played it because people will always play burn. But now it's, you know, it's been our gauntlet front runner for the last couple of months because Eidolon just throws it up there as one of the best decks in the format.
And then there was Eidolon, and then they just printed a Tarka's Command, which replaces Boros Charm in the deck as, like,
just a stronger...
Yeah, you don't have to play white anymore. Now you just play red or green-red, and it's... That card's so good. That card in burn is insane.
Right.
It's crazy. So, yeah, I just – our friend Spencer played at a PPTQ this last weekend, and he told me he played against Burn 4 times. Yeah. All of them sporting
Well, it's not that expensive. It's a relatively inexpensive deck. And arguably, this is probably one of the best decks if you want to get into Modern to start with.
Yeah.
Especially after Masters of Modern comes out. Like, sorry, Modern Masters comes out.
I always make that case. I know.
Goblin Guide is like a pretty firm lock of being in that set, and it's probably the most expensive card in Burn.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think that, well, it's not going to be expensive now. Long term, Tarka's Command is going to be real expensive, I promise you.
Right, so pick those up, Burn players, and Eidolon. I mean, Eidolon's probably the one that's going to be the most expensive.
How much is that now, like $6?
Ten. It might be cheaper. It might be at $6. It should be at $10.
Pick a bunch of those up, yeah.
So the way it works, so you're playing Burn. Your point is to point red spells at your opponent's face and kill them that way, or play creatures that just do a ton of damage. The best spell I've talked to Burn players is Goblin Guide. Yeah. Goblin Guide is the best spell in the deck.
They'll say if they can get 4 out of it, it's done its job, and if they get 6, it's just icing.
Right. And it has the highest damage ratio to mana cost, and that's kind of what Burn is about. It's a lot of math. Surprisingly, it's probably one of the most math-heavy archetypes in Magic's history.
Yeah, it is really fascinating when you watch a high-level set of players and they're playing Burn. The look on a Burn player's face is often the same look as a combo player, and I think it's because Burn does feel in a lot of ways like a combo deck.
It's more combo than aggro.
Yeah.
More often. It can be aggro. It can lean towards the aggro side, and you can play an aggro game with it, but it's definitely much more combo-y.
Yeah, which is just sort of fascinating. You wouldn't really think that Burn is combo. But I think the versions that get played nowadays are much more combo-centric, especially with Eidolon.
Classically, they almost are, because, like, you're not you are attacking them, but you're not really attacking them. Yes, it has to do with the life total, but so does Storm. And Storm is, how many spells can I cast to kill my opponent? And Burn is, how many spells can I cast to kill my opponent?
It's true.
You know, the classic all lightning bolt deck from way back when there were no deck limits. That's kind of the first Burn deck, and that was all just, I need to get to 7 lightning bolts.
Yeah.
And how quickly can I accomplish that before my opponent kills me?
Let's start with the best deck in Modern. Black, green, X, or whatever you'd call it. I guess these days it's probably Abzan midrange, whatever we're calling
it. Yeah, the black, green deck.
Historically, those decks. I would say that the Abzan version that sports Siege Rhino is way more resilient to Burn.
Right.
Like,
well, and white decks are always going to be red's biggest problem.
Yeah.
Of its enemies. I mean, red has blue, but blue doesn't have the same effects that kind of fight red. And that's because life gain. And, like, these decks often have just arbitrary life gains associated with them. And now, you know, Abzan is kind of 2 decks in the format. There's, like, the Birthing Pod Lights.
Right.
That now exist with Collected Company or Whitleaf Liege that I have, like, 4 ofs of Kitchen Finx.
Yeah. And also, what's the card? Congregation at Dawn.
Congregation of Dawn. Like, these are cards that are just like, oh, they're getting life just because. But now, every time a Kitchen Finx dies, that's basically a spell you have to draw to
kill
them.
Every time a Kitchen Finx dies, somebody's heart breaks a little bit who plays Burn. I don't know.
And then the other one sometimes plays Kitchen Finx, but more importantly is playing Siege Rhino. And those are the 2 cards that Burn kind of has to get under.
But
a lot of the help in this fight is Eidolon. I think Eidolon does a lot of work in fighting these decks because a lot of these decks are like Thoughtseize and their mana base is really wide. So they have to, like, they're already hurting themselves. So Burn in these situations, it's very much a race. So I think this is its worst matchup of, like, our gauntlet.
Probably, yeah. It's not going to usually be fast enough to outrace the combination of 4 Finks and 2 to 4 Rhino
right
in a main deck. along with some removal and disruption.
Right.
Like, there's enough cards that just aren't going to be in an Abzan player's hand to begin the game that, unless they have a nutso draw, you probably...
And that's just game one. I mean, like, Ooze comes in eventually or is already in the deck. That's random life gain. You have the cards, like, the definitive, like, anti-burn cards are just, like, some ubiquitous amount of life gain plus blocker plus, like, there are so many things out of the board in white that it definitely is the biggest roadblock.
A bunch of decks play the gain 8 life card now. Right?
Just gain 8 life.
The ferocious one.
Yeah.
Or you gains 10.
I know a bunch of decks, but some decks.
I've seen sideboards. Yeah, it's a gain 10 life.
Right.
Pretty good. Okay, so that's matchup number one. Let's go number two, Infect.
This is a race, obviously. The difference is that Burn can kill their creatures, and once you get an Eidolon in play, I don't know how Infect beats you.
I just think that an Infect player knows... I think that Infect has the edge here, more over Burn.
You do?
Yeah, and I think the reason is because a lot of infect spells are plus up, so they have multiples, and so unless the burn player is saving like 3 lightning bolts to like aim at the creature, the infect player is going to have like vines as well as like giant growth or mutagenic growth. They'll have like multiple spells to stack against the burn damage, and they're going to be able to push through for their lethal swing. Or a smart infect player might save all that stuff for their one swing. And they'll
build up top.
It's like, you can kill my guy.
The reason I was thinking that this is rough is because, and it comes down to, you need to know what you're doing, but I guess Infect, you should always try killing the creatures at sorcery speed. This is something a lot of people don't know when playing Infect. And because if they have to use a spell like that to stop a burn spell, that means they don't have it on their turn to kill you with it.
Yeah, they're like using a counter spell instead of a pump spell.
Like they're not giant growth, but giant growth is way less problematic if they're doing it and not attacking you with it.
You're saying the metaphorical giant growth?
Yeah, the metaphorical giant growth. and so that's kind of the way you have to play this. And then once Eidolon is in play, all of their cards chalk them then. Their entire deck is 2 drops, or like 2 or 1 drops. They have no 3 drops in the deck.
If they can resolve Eidolon on turn 2, I think it swings largely in their favor.
Right.
So I think you have a point.
There's definitely a race feel to it also, because like Goblin Guide into Eidolon into just, I'm going to burn your creatures out and you can't cast a spell for the rest of the game.
Yeah.
It seems really hard for Infect to get past.
Amulet Bloom, you have 0 interaction with them.
Oh, yeah. It's who kills first. Like, and if Eidolon...
They're swingier. You're more consistent. You're a consistent turn 4 deck. They're an inconsistent turn 2 deck.
Right.
So depending on the spectrum where they fall, which is maybe why this deck's going to get banned eventually.
Amulet Bloom?
Maybe.
I don't think so. I've been talked to enough people recently that I think it's the type of kind of play style they want to be available. Because, yes, it can win on turn 0, but so can Goro's Vengeance.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it will. I just mean when you have decks like this was a pretty prominent deck from like a couple big tournaments recently. So if it continues to put up finishes like that.
Well, I mean, we talked about this with Tom, it's very possible Aaron Forsythe is like thinking about it right now, like, okay, what do I do with what do I do for the next Pro Tour? How do I make it interesting?
Right.
And it very well could come with Splinter Twin and Amulet Bloom are banned.
That'd be such a horrible decision.
I know. God, I don't want it to happen, but it's definitely something that's possible.
The outcry would be ridiculous.
next on the list is Twin. It's a race. It's a race. Well,
yeah, it's a race, but also their best card against you costs or has 4 toughness, which just sucks for you.
Right, so they need to draw that one card. I think as long as they don't get their 1/4, you're in the clear because you can kill everything. You have lightning bolts to kill their other things and interaction, and otherwise they don't have a way to kind of stop you because you can just kill them quickly.
Yeah.
Like, Burn so often plays as a tempo deck. I think it goes between tempo and combo. I rarely think it's really a pure aggro deck because you can never block out a burn deck very easily.
Sure.
And that's kind of the way it goes about. So, like, it really becomes, I'm killing your creatures while trying to get some damage into you, which is tempo versus anything else. Last but not least, Affinity.
So this is a pure race.
This is pure race.
Yeah, but your removal spells are better than their removal spells.
Yeah, you lightning bolt their things and you get Eidolon in play. I just don't. Like, Eidolon is so powerful, and that's why the reason this deck has gone from tier 2 to tier 1. But, like, Eidolon against Affinity.
Yeah.
Really good. If you get it on turn 2 and they, like, didn't play out their whole hand, I don't know how they win.
Yeah.
Like, they could literally kill themselves accidentally by just casting every spell in their hand. It's definitely a race, but I definitely think you're favored.
Yeah, if your trump card is a burn player is Eidolon, I would argue their trump card as an affinity player is Etch Champion, because as soon as they resolve Etch Champion, basically their cranial plating plan goes to, like, I'm going to just dome you for 9 next turn. You can't interact with me because I definitely have Metalcraft.
That's a turn 4, and Burn can kill you on turn 4.
Burn's a turn, yeah, it's a turn 4 deck, but also...
And Goblin Guide isn't very good against them, but the other thing that they do have access to is, and we haven't really talked about it, is...
Galvanic Blast?
No, Lavamancer. Is Lavamancer at a burn for affinity, because you just start picking off you get to use your burn spells to, you know, throw at their face, and then you have Lavamancer killing off their little dirtily dudes on the floor.
Yeah, true.
One of the benefits that affinity does have is Phyrexian Black Mana spell.
Oh, Vault Scourge.
Yeah. One of the advantages that affinity does have is Vault Scourge.
Yeah.
And because life gain is good against affinity or burn. Something that isn't on our gauntlet, and there's not really a deck for it, but I do want to mention it against Burn, is, like, control long game decks. And it's one of the reasons they're not very good in Modern right now, is you can't do that against Burn, because Burn eventually is going to outdraw threats to your, like, their threats are spells, and spells are, they're not enough good counter spells in the format right now where control can really fight on that access.
Yeah.
So eventually, and it's the reason, like, control is really hard to also fight Snapcaster Mage Bolt decks, because eventually they're just going to realize, oh, I can just Snapcaster Bolt you out of the game, and I just have to draw enough Snapcaster Mages and Bolts to kill you.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of feel of, like, you can't go long against Burn, because unlike, like, aggro decks, because that's, like, the difference between Burn and aggro, is aggro you can go long against because you can just answer their spells.
Sure,
just kill their creatures, get a blocker into play, and be fine. Against Burn, it's like, no, they're going to, you know, draw enough lightning bolts to just kill me.
Right. I would say that's pretty much, I think Burn's pretty well positioned right now. I think you probably will see a lot more of it in the near future. I think Katarka's Command makes a big difference. And we will see how that develops. Otherwise, this is a rando thought. I just want to throw this another like stupid thing at you guys. But I've been working on this deck, and I'm just going to name a couple cards for you guys. Just tweet at me about these cards, just because it's, like, one of the more preposterous decks I've worked at in a while. So the nutso play is Burning Tree Emissary on turn 2 directly into Mir Superion. The deck also plays Ethervile, Apocrysite, and tons of 2-mana cards that have lots of advantage, including Ojutai's Command. So that's kind of where I'm going with the deck. Collected Companies in there as well. If you guys have any cards that are, like, super sweet that you want to throw out at me, they're probably in the list already or on the cutting room floor, but I will be working on that deck. So thanks for listening.
As always, every week I ask people on Twitter a question before we start recording, and I got some answers. This week I asked, what are the top 3 Planeswalkers of all time?
Jace.
So Austin Bach, friend of the cast, responded with Birthing Pod number 1.
Yeah.
John Fairley, who is at J Fairley. I think I said your name correctly, which I probably didn't.
It was a fair attempt.
Yeah. Jace the Mind Sculptor, followed by Liliana, and ... can't choose.
That was kind of, yeah, we had similar feelings.
Eric Landis, at Proggy Boog. I always say your name wrong, I'm assuming. Jace, Liliana the Veil, Karn. We mentioned Karn. Yeah. Karn is definitely up there.
Very powerful.
And last... but not least, Alex Belty, great name.
Yeah,
it's good. It's a good, strong,
because your name, because your name's Alex.
Who is at Alex_Belty? Jace the Mind Sculptor, and then he puts Elsbeth as second, and then he follows it with Liliana the Veil or Johnny Vengeance. So he doesn't even think Liliana might even, like, cement itself as a third. So we just answered your questions from this week. To answer for next week, what Legacy cards do you want to see legal and Modern? This kind of means, you know, not necessarily cards that are banned that you want to see unbanned, but cards that are not possibly legal in Modern. So stuff that has been printed in stuff like Commander products, like Scavenging Ooze was, stuff that's, you know, in older sets that isn't legal. So Counterspell, which shouldn't be in the format.
No.
Kind of cards that, you know, you would like to see either printed in Standard to be legal in Modern, or, you know, maybe Wizards comes up with a new way, like Modern Masters, to print cards in the Modern.
Yeah, we've sort of talked about it. So we have some ideas. What we may or may not do an episode on this in the near future. We want to know your guys' thoughts. As always, we want to remind you to check out our sister podcast, The Command Zone, with Jimmy Wong and Josh Lee Kwai.
They do awesome content. It's cool. Yeah. I like listening to it. You don't play Commander, so, but
yeah,
I do on occasion.
They're good dudes, yeah. And they're smart about Magic. So.
Next, we are starting to post videos on YouTube. Some of it will be these podcasts, so if you listen to this already, that might not be as interesting, but we're also going to start releasing other video content. So if you go to our YouTube channel, search for Top Decking TV or Webisodes Network. It's / Webisodes Network, and check that out. See some cool stuff there. Extra content. Please follow us on Twitter. We are at the MMCast. I am at Kes Wiley.
I'm on Periscope at @BenBatemanMedia, as well as Twitter and Instagram.
Periscope? What is that?
It's the new live streaming app.
Oh.
Yeah, I just go shoulders up and take my shirt off and go talk to me 5 minutes.
That's weird.
Just kidding.
That's weird.
Only halfway. People like my collarbones, man. It's just a thing on Periscope, okay?
That's fair enough. After following us on Twitter, go to iTunes, subscribe, rate us there. It'll be cool. If you subscribe us, more people will be able to find us on the Magic the Gathering podcastness, which will be good for everyone.
Yeah.
Speaking of that note, this episode was actually brought to you guys by the Grimoire Box. It is this cool leather-bound book. It's got, you can put your cards in it. You feel like you're casting spells out of a magic spell book, which is pretty sweet. If you go to wizardryfoundry.com and use the code MMCAST, you get 10% off. So try doing that. It'll make them happy with us, and then maybe we'll get more sponsors, and we'll be more podcastness for you guys. We will see you guys next week. This has been Alex Kessler.
I'm Ben Bateman.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to the mmcast@rocketjump.com. See you later, alligator.